Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello, Bob Wells here, and welcome to another episode of Undercurrent Stories. Most of us suffer at some point from some sort of body condition that causes an issue of sorts. For example, you may have to wear glasses or contacts. You may have had a bad back. Or you may have work done on your teeth to straighten them. Have you ever wondered why? Well, here to answer some of those questions, I'm delighted to be joined by Alex Bezeridis. Alex is a professor of biology at Lewis Clark State College in Idaho, where he teaches a wide range of biology classes, from human anatomy and physiology to entomology. He has a bachelor's degree in biology and a PhD in neurobiology and behaviour. He recently brought out his first book called Evolution Gone Wrong, The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't. Hello and welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I've just listened to your book, which was really interesting. I've learnt, obviously we're going to answer some of those questions hopefully in the interview, but I've learnt so much that I didn't know or knew very little about, and it answers some of those questions. But also it was written in a, shall we say, and I'm not from an academic background, it wasn't written heavily in academic jargon, although there are words there that I had to read twice. But it was easy to read, and I did like that sense of humour, which sort of made it flow and actually made it more entertaining and enjoyable. So great book, Alex.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yeah, I tried to kind of get it in a conversational, informal style. I wanted it to be, you know, it's a science book, it's a nonfiction science book, but I did not want it to be dry. So hopefully I accomplished that.
Before we talk about some of this stuff, I was doing a bit of reading into your academic career. And I note that you're also a songwriter. You're into sports such as paddleboarding, and you've designed frisbee courses. Could you tell us a little about the frisbee course and how that came about, please?
Yeah, I kind of got into, so frisbee golf, for people that don't know, it's basically like playing golf, but you're throwing a, you know, you're throwing a frisbee around instead of hitting a ball, and you throw it into a basket, and the courses are usually arranged as, you know, as 9 holes or 18 holes, and it's gotten really popular. And when I moved here, I'd kind of gotten into it in graduate school and really enjoyed playing. And I came here, and there's about 60, 70,000 people in our community on two sides of the river in two states, and there wasn't a frisbee golf course. And I thought, this is kind of crazy, because any community that size anymore, in the States anyway, has a frisbee golf course, or two or three. And so I got in touch with the city, and it turns out they were in the process of putting one in. Somebody was doing it for their final Eagle Scout project or something like that, but they didn't have anybody that knew what they were doing in terms of laying it out. They didn't have anybody that played. So I hopped in there and designed that one, and it's a really popular one in town. It gets played all the time. And since then, we've put in another one in town, and I did another one up in the mountains. So it's just kind of a neat thing to do, because it just gets people outside, and it's such an accessible sport. You know, it takes $10 to go buy a couple of discs. That's all you have to do. There's not greens fees like with a golf course. The equipment isn't expensive like with a golf course. I really like it.
No, it sounds good. I must give it a go. Before we talk about evolution, could you please just tell us a bit about yourself in terms of your sort of life's journey, how you grew up, and sort of what made you decide to become involved in biology, teaching and becoming a professor in what you've done? Could you just have a bit of background on that? I think it'll help. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, I was always into the outdoors and always, I mean, had parents that always got us outside. So I spent a lot of time outdoors as a kid, and that kind of pointed me in a biological direction. Had some really positive experiences in secondary school with, you know, 10th, 11th grade with biology teachers. So I went off to college thinking, oh, I'll probably do something like that. But I didn't know what the options were sort of career wise. Kind of went off like most, a lot of 18, 19, 20 year olds that are interested in biology thinking, I'll become a physician. I shadowed a physician or two. And I don't know, that life didn't look like exactly what I wanted. You know, I didn't like the idea of, well, at the time they all had pagers on their hips, you know, and they were always on call. And I just didn't, the work-life balance there didn't strike me as great. So I got to be friends with one of my profs as an undergraduate. He taught the comparative animal physiology class at Colorado State. Dr. Greg Florent was his name. And we just kind of, I took his class and then we just kind of hit it off and I started spending time with him. We'd go fishing together and I got to know a lot about, he studied fat metabolism and hibernation and marmots. So he had this kind of cool field component to his research. And I really liked the look of his life. You know, he'd work all day Saturday so that he could take off on Tuesday and go do something, you know, as long as he didn't have class. And it was like, he was sort of very much, it seemed like he was very much in charge of kind of his career. I mean, he obviously he had a division chair or something that was kind of his quote boss, but there was a degree of independence there that was attractive to me. So at that point I thought, all right, I'll pursue that path. And that means going to graduate school. I wasn't sure what I was going to go to graduate school to study. I was really into neurobiology. I really liked the idea of getting in there and digging into acetylcholine receptors. These are the receptors that are sort of at the intersection of a nerve and a muscle. You have this receptor that the neurotransmitter binds to, and then ions flow through it, and that's sort of how your muscles work. And you know, we're still working out the details of all those kinds of molecular interactions. And I thought, oh, I'll go do that. And so I went to graduate school to do that. And I got there, and about 20 minutes after I arrived, the prof that I was going to work with retired. So I was like, okay, time to pivot. And I went to a school where it was really neat. The first year, you got to rotate through several different labs. So I just got to pick one for the first, you know, after she had retired, I just picked a different one. And I picked a Drosophila genetics lab where they were studying protein trafficking it's sort of the similar area at the neuromuscular junction. Did that for a few months, liked that, but didn't love it. And then did a couple more rotations. And at the end of that period, I ended up with a chemical ecologist that used insects mostly for his work. And studied sort of the chemicals that they use for their reproduction and for their defense. And that's what I ended up working on for the PhD. I did all this work on this little moth that lives in Florida that has this wild biology where it sequesters this alkaloid that makes it so other things can't eat it. And then it uses that to signal the mates. And it's got all this fascinating biology. And when you reach the end of graduate school, you kind of reach a point where you sort of have to decide now, what kind of life do you want? Do you want a R1 writing grants all the time, big lab with postdocs and graduate students and sort of try to head down that path kind of life? Or do you want something that's a little more teaching heavy where you dabble in research, you kind of keep active with it, you do, you know, you get some undergraduates into it, but it's not the dominant focus. And I kind of wanted that. I was sort of tired of I went to a pretty pressure cooker grad school. And I was a little tired of that grind already. It had only been 5 years. And so I sort of chose to take that other path where, you know, most of your time is spent in the classroom, but you can keep a little active with research if you want. And I think it was a good decision. You know, I only moved schools a couple of times. I started with a job in the Midwest and I was there for a few years, but all my family's in the Western part of the US. So my wife and I looked for jobs out here in the West and settled in. We've been here a long time. So I think it's all worked out pretty well.
I guess it must be interesting working with students who ask questions, and there must be questions that you get on a day-to-day basis that you probably haven't heard before, which then sort of challenge you.
Yeah. And honestly, the book was kind of born out of those questions. I teach a lot of, there's a big nursing program here at this college where I teach. And so I teach the sort of pre-nursing classes, the ones they have to take before they get into the program, a couple semesters of anatomy and physiology. And in those classes, the students just, they know that I really like why questions. You know, we spend so much time focused on the proximate level things about how a kidney, how the kidney actually works, or you know, all the intricate physiology that you do in those classes. But I really like to think about that bigger picture about why it ended up the way it was. And so my students are naturally kind of, after a few weeks of the class, they start thinking that way. And they asked a lot of these questions about why our teeth don't fit in our mouths, or why we all have knee and hip issues as we get older. And the book was really born out of those questions. You know, a lot of them, especially with the teeth, I kind of started with teeth, and it's the first chapter of the book. I didn't have kind of the foggiest idea why so many people need to have wisdom teeth pulled, why so many people need correction. And I started to read about it. And when I did, the answers were, well, A, they were very complicated, and B, they were spectacularly fascinating. I mean, they were really interesting. So I'd bring bits and pieces back to the classroom, but I slowly started to write some of it down. And that eventually kind of became an outline for chapter one that sort of got me off and running.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it would be helpful before we talk about some of the results of the evolution that have gone wrong or not as we would wish. Maybe just a sort of a very, very brief summary overview of how humans came into existence, because we came from the sea originally, didn't we? Is it possible for you just to sort of do a sort of whirlwind summary of where we came from, where we are now, and then we can talk about some of the idiosyncrasies that through evolution.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, you bet. So, and you kind of get a good view of this in the book. It happens. It has to be addressed multiple times because a lot of our issues are born of things of anatomy that first evolved in the water. So yeah, the very important thing to recognize there is that all life on Earth started in the ocean and was in the ocean for a very long time. You know, if you're going all the way back to bacteria, it's for billions of years. If you're talking animals, it's hundreds of millions of years. So you have the first animals in the ocean for hundreds of millions of years before anything, including plants, before anything is out of the water. So a lot of the foundational vertebrate anatomy, the way our mouths get set up, the way our eyes are set up, the way even the first sort of elements of the skeleton, it all evolved in the water. And that right there sets us up for some very interesting sort of things that we have to deal with on land, because it's an entirely different existence, right? The way that the light gets to your eye is different. The way that your body weight is supported is different. So eventually, after, call it, about 100-150 million years after the first vertebrates evolved in the water, there were fish that got out of the water. And there are great examples of fossils that researchers have found that show that mark that transition. One of which was only found in the last, 10 or 20 years, this fossil I bring up in the book, Tiktaalik, which is now kind of like the classic transitional fossil between it's got half fish features and it has sort of half amphibian feature. So it has fins, but they're kind of these lobe-like fins that allow it to a little bit of locomotion, in low water. And it has a lot of the fish that get out of water come from a group that are called, one of the still living examples is a fish called a lungfish. So they have air-filled organs. The ones that stayed in the water use them to just kind of move up and down in the water column. But the ones that got out of the water, they use their air-filled organs as a lung. So now we're out of the water. That's a huge step. then reptiles kind of take off at that point, thicker skin, a thicker egg with more of a membrane in it so that the egg doesn't dry out on land. That gets you more away from the water. And then that reptilian group is sort of that then branches out. There's like a zillion different habitats on land that were not filled. So some of the reptiles just go on to do reptile-like things. And that's how you end up with turtles and lizards and birds, which are just flying reptiles. But another group kind of went rogue and got away from the egg laying style and sort of incubated everything internally. And that leads to the placental mammals. Now there's other mammals too, but the bulk of them are the placental mammals. And so, by that point in time, now we're getting closer to modern time, but you're still 50 million years ago. Even before that, even 100 million years ago, when those are kind of starting to really get a foothold, the next big event is the mass extinction event at 65 million years ago, the one that wiped out most of the dinosaurs, which now looks like there's pretty indisputable evidence that it was caused by a meteor crashing into the Earth and changing the quality, changing the atmosphere, and that most things didn't survive through that, but some of the little, most of the dinosaurs went away at that point, but there were mammals that were around, and they kind of had more of a foothold then without the giant dinosaurs to have to deal with. And so mammals really start to take off at that point, 65 million years ago. And that's, then there's more diversification. That's when we start to get our primate lineages, and then, eventually one of those paths kind of leads to us. For me, the other I like to think of the big events, you know, the getting out of water, huge event, the meteor sort of changing the atmosphere, making it so that mammals didn't have as much competition, huge event. The other giant event that sets us on our path toward becoming human is the switch from a life in the trees to a life on the ground, which happened in our lineage about 5-6 million years ago. And then that forces all kinds of changes throughout the human body. So at this point, to be clear, 5-6 million years ago, still no humans at all on Earth. We are only talking about human ancestors. Things like Lucy's species, that very famous fossil Lucy, she's an Australopithecus. You know, that's an organism, that's a species from 3-4 million years ago. And then as you get closer and closer to our time, the brains start to get really big. We're becoming more adept at bipedal life, getting around on 2 feet. And by the time you push into, I forget where I read it once, but somebody described it as like, what's the first point in time where if you sat down on the subway next to the organism, you might actually think the thing was kind of human-like rather than some other kind of hominid. And that point in time, because it's all sort of a blurry transition, right? It's not like there's like some bang, this is the event with the first human. It's just kind of this blurry transition into humanism. And, you know, most people are now pegging that event to be in the 200,000 to 300,000 year ago range. At which point we really don't have, you know, the vocal anatomy is still really minimal compared to the way it is now. We're starting to look and act human, and we're living in these very social groups, and a lot of the qualities that we've carried through to the modern time are entrenched at that point. And so the first Homo sapiens, you're looking at, you know, going back about 250,000 years or something like that, and that gets us up to our modern selves sitting here in heated and air conditioned offices drinking filtered water. How did I do? That was about 6 minutes. I think Carl Sagan did it in about 7 minutes in Cosmos. So we'll see. And he had the use of images and animations and stuff. So I had to, see how I did in getting it done about five. It's a big job to pull off in 5 minutes.
It is. Yeah, no, you did very well on that. So that's helped. That certainly helped me and probably the listeners understand. So we as Homo sapiens, we really haven't been here very long, have we?
That's a really important point. We have not been around that long. And I stress that a lot in the book. You know, when you think about something like the foot, and I like to compare it to a bird, like birds are the best example of another biped. And birds have been bipeds for 100 million years. And 100 million years is a long time to work out the kinks of being a biped. Well, we've only been bipeds for 5 million years. And as a consequence, you know, we're still kind of working the kinks out. The ankles like to roll, the knees blow out, the hips give us trouble. You know, it could be a very different story if we're lucky enough to be around in 95 million more years. I would imagine we'll be much better bipeds.
Let's start off on teeth. So I mentioned earlier on, you know, a lot of us have problems with teeth. I'm not talking about sort of rotten teeth with sugar, but basically the shape of our teeth. Why do we have so many issues with teeth, Alex?
Yeah, that one all drives to the relationship between the jaw and the teeth. And for that one, you do have to get back into the water and look at the first examples of teeth in animals. And the crazy thing here is the first teeth in animals, they're not in the mouth. There are these hard structures on some of the earliest fish that cover their skin, call them denticles. And then some other fish have teeth down in their throats, they're all the way down here. And eventually those teeth make their way up to the jaw, or at least up to the oral cavity. And some of them don't even have a jaw. Whenever I give talks, I carry a lamprey around. A lamprey is this eel-like fish. There's actually still a fair amount of them around here, so the people locally in Idaho know this fish. And they're this crazy looking fish with this mouth that they have oral teeth, but they have no jaw. They just suck onto things. They suck onto the sides of other fishes and make a living as a parasite. And the point I like to stress there is that the teeth and the jaw are independent structures. And just because one changes, it doesn't mean that the other one's going to go along with it. And that effectively is the problem. So you work through our evolutionary history and we have these moments where one of them undergoes dramatic change. For example, when you have that shift 5-6 million years ago, like I mentioned, from a life in the trees to a life on the ground, the biggest, well, so there were lots of things to deal with there, but one of the huge changes that humans had to deal with was a dramatic change in diet. You go from eating sort of soft squishy mangoes to having to chew through, you know, some raw tuber that's in the ground. And during that transitional period, during that couple million years, the molars got huge because the only animals that were going to survive on the ground were ones that could chew through these things. So you end up, and the jaw, again, it's independent. The jaw, that's for the first time when you start to sort of end up with a with teeth that are a little too big for the jaw. Now, it was still a pretty big, powerful jaw because at that point we were not cutting food. We were not cooking food. We were not putting it in a pot and making it mushy or anything. But then as the brain gets bigger and we get craftier with all those kinds of things, we start to process the food. You get it to a point where you don't even really need a strong, powerful jaw. You can just kind of make it mush. You can cook the meat until it's really soft. And the jaw gets really weak. If you look at our jaw and small, if you look at our jaw compared to a chimpanzee, you know, they have these giant, still powerful jaws. And we have these pretty small, comparatively wimpy jaws that are still sort of stuck with those remnant huge molars. Well, there's your problem. And there are things you can do. You know, you can feed your kids harder foods to chew, make them really get their jaw up to its maximum potential, which I think, so all of this is kind of a blend of evolutionary issues and modern issues. I think for each topic in the book, you can maybe place the blame more on one side than the other, but for all of them, it's a blend of both. Teeth are a place where I think most of the blame is in the past, but we shoulder some of it by not working our jaws enough during the developmental years.
Yeah. So as our jaws got smaller, the teeth were almost sort of having to play catch up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they are, you know, they're shrinking over time. If you look at the size of teeth over the last 100,000 years, they're shrinking quite a bit. But now, you know, and it's not a bad thing that are sort of curbing natural selection in this way. I mean, I like being able to go and get my teeth straightened and fixed and making them work a little better, but it does impact the way that evolution is going to work on this issue, right? We all go to the, you know, a lot of people end up getting these issues fixed, and they in that sense don't have nearly the impact on our reproductive success that they once did. Whereas back in the day, if your teeth didn't fit in your mouth very well and you couldn't get enough food, you weren't going to pass, you know, you were unlikely to pass those sort of poor mismatched tooth jaw genes on. These days, you can have grossly mismatched jaw and teeth, get it all cleaned up, go on a date, meet a girl, have three kids that you pass on your tooth jaw mismatch too, you know, and that's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing.
I mean, so there's two questions on that, actually. The first one is natural selection. I think most of us and most of our listeners know what natural selection is, but I'd just like to clarify that, because my understanding with natural selection is that, and you mentioned there about the teeth, is that is it all done by sexual attraction? In other words, are mates attracted to each other? If somebody's got, shall we say, a part of their anatomy that is going to be long term benefit, They're going to be attracted more to that than another human that hasn't. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. It's important to recognize that it is one of the mechanisms by which evolution occurs. There are others. Yeah. You know, the DNA can mutate. That's a mechanism that can drive evolution. You can get animals just moving around from place to place and mixing groups so they can leave, they can come in. That can drive evolution. So there are other mechanisms by which evolution occurs, but I would argue the most important one is this idea of natural selection. And I hate that, you know, people have got this thing sort of tied in their head of the survival of the fittest, which is an expression I try and avoid in class, because it is, the focus needs to be on reproduction. Because it's more like reproduction of the fittest. It's differential reproduction based on heritable traits. So you need variability in a trait, and the teeth and the jaws is a great spot where you have a ton of variability. And then you need reproductive interests and mate selection being driven somewhat by that variability. And of course, all kinds of traits are going to be involved in this process. You're going to have physical traits, you're going to have personality traits. All kinds of different things are going to play a role in that natural selective milieu. And I just kind of pick them off one at a time in the book. And with something like the tooth and jaw, I think it's pretty indisputable that in most places, that is playing less of a role in natural selection than it did even just a few generations ago when not everybody could get it fixed.
So that's because of our intervention to improve
because of our intervention. Now, to be clear,
so it's slowing down natural evolution, I guess.
In that one physical realm, yes, it would be.
Yeah.
But to be clear, natural selection is absolutely still occurring. We're just sort of shifting it to other human features, right? Like we are still attracted to and not attracted to certain traits. It just is going to move around as it always has through time.
So that's teeth. I think the other. I mean, we can go through the whole body, and obviously we haven't got time to go through everything, and people can read the book. But eye problems. I mean, pardon the pun. I have a problem with my eye. You know, a lot of people do, and particularly as we get older, we have to wear reading glasses.
Yeah, these would not have been on here two. These would not have been on here 2 years ago, but they have to be on here now.
No. Yeah, it happens to us all. So could you just explain for listeners why we have these issues with the eye as well? Because it's fascinating. Yeah.
The eye is a fascinating one. You have to go back in the water again and recognize that the vertebrate eye evolved in the water, which means the vertebrate eye evolved to be wet. That right there drives some pretty interesting anatomy about our eye. It's why we have to keep it wet. It evolved to be wet. It has to stay wet. So we make quite a volume of tears every day. I bring it up in the book. I have a 1 liter bottle here. This is, you know, what's left in here right now. There's about 700 milliliters left in here. It's not nearly that much, but you make about 300 milliliters or so a day of tears every day. You make that many tears just to keep your eyes wet. You have to blink a gazillion times every day to get them dragged across your eye to keep
That's
it wet.
That's fascinating.
Wild. All these things just because the eye evolved wet. And if it doesn't stay wet, it's a huge problem. But the eye is an interesting one because the eye's been out of the water for so long now that it's become supremely adapted to life on land. And we have these structures, the cornea and the lens that can refract the light and bend it to help it land on the retina at the back of the eye. And it works. It works pretty darn well. It's just if during those early developmental years, if the eye doesn't develop to the right length, which seems to be coming, it's becoming more and more common, then the light lands right before the retina, and that's nearsightedness, or it lands behind the retina, and that's farsightedness. And people are trying to figure out why this is becoming more of a problem in the modern age, because the myopia rates are just skyrocketing. You go, you know, 20 years ago, maybe 20% of the world was myopic. And now it's, you know, one generation later, it's up to a third of the world has myopia. And it's looking like, and by 2050, they're saying it's going to be about half the world's population will have myopia. And the leading hypothesis for what's going on here, and there's now some pretty good evidence to support it, is that it has to do with all the time we're spending inside, and the light, the eye is not getting its sort of natural development that it has always had spending time outside. Whether or not that's having the amount of light coming in, whether or not it's focusing on things that aren't so close and being, you know, focusing on the horizon and on the distance, exactly why it's happening, you know, exactly the mechanism, I don't think is understood. But there's mounting evidence that we need to kick our kids out of the basement and outside if you want to give their eye a chance to develop to the right length, and you kind of have that window of period of time when they're children to do it. And if you don't nail it, then they're doomed. I mean, I didn't have to do these till I'm a good anecdotal example of this. I was pretty lucky with my eyes. Spent a ton of time outside as a kid. And my distance vision is still spectacular. I mean, but now the older you get, there are going to be some things you cannot avoid. Eventually those muscles get a little tired of bending your lens your whole life and you're stuck with these, but not the eyes. Yeah. The eye is one where I think more of the blame is actually in the modern lifestyle than in the past. We have some quirks due to the past, but I actually think more of the blame with the eye is, it's a unique one for that in that sense in the book. Most of the book is about blaming the past.
Yes, it is. Right. And you, Yeah, you raise a very good point there. And it was a question that you were putting through in the book on certain occasions, and one that I kept asking myself. And I'd like to talk about it after we've spoken about a couple more of the human issues. But really, about what now we know all this, what possible things can we do to alleviate future problems, and also things in the future that we can see happening. But perhaps if we leave that to the end, that'd be great. But I think there's the windpipe and the food pipe. I mean, they're ridiculously close to each other, aren't they? You wouldn't design a body like that, but they are.
Yeah, it's a great example of a place where we are so clearly not intelligently designed, because we're not designed. You would never put those two structures right next to one another. You would bring the air in this way, and I don't know. I mean, the stomach's down here. Not that much happens digestive wise. You break down a few sugars in your mouth, but you could pull that off somewhere else. You would just put a tube down here and just connect it to your stomach if you were going to design the thing. Hey, you just grab your fish and chips and you just stick it right there, and you would avoid the whole issue of choking. But you know, the kicker here is that the passageways, one sort of evolved from the other. There was always a digestive tract, and the airway evolved sort of as an out pocket from that. And so they were always going to be sort of intimately related, because one just kind of came off as a bedroom off of the hallway that was already there. And there you go. And the fascinating thing about that one for me is just sort of the random coin flip of which type of fish got out of the water. Because there are some fish that have their air-filled organs, rather than in the front, they have them more sort of positioned dorsally. In fact, it's the bulk of fish that are that way. Most of the fish that we know, all the trout and bluegill and salmon and perch and tuna and all those things, they all have their air-filled organs toward the back. But the fish that scrambled out of the water have their air-filled organs toward the front. And what it makes is that when we bring the air in, we mostly bring it in now through our nose, it starts in the back. It sort of ends up, back in here. And then it has to cross back over to the front, because our lungs are obviously in the front. And then you end up with an intersection. You end up with an intersection of the food way, the food passageway, the digestive tract, the esophagus, and the air passageway. And that intersection can be a little clunky. It's particularly clunky for little kids, because their air passageway is so spectacularly small that any little thing can get hung up in there. I was learning all about this right when my daughter was pretty young. And the poor thing, I mean, you wouldn't believe how much we mutilated every grape and every hot dog and everything. Yeah. Until she was about 9 years old, there was nothing allowed on her plate that wasn't just teeny. Because I'd read all these horror stories about, about little kids. That it's a really common thing, little kids, that food gets, if it just goes down, if it goes down the wrong path, in most adults, you have a strong enough cough and a big enough tube that you don't usually die. Now, people still do, there's plenty of people that still die from choking, but it's really an issue for little kids. And then the elderly, as you get later in life, the muscles that allow you that stronger cough start to weaken, and the muscles that help with the separation start to weaken. And so it becomes an issue, as so many things do, sort of you see it at the beginning and then it comes up again at the end. It's just a wild one. And the most fascinating piece of it for me, the reason it even made the book, was when I learned about this idea. So there is a safeguard in there in humans. It's called your epiglottis. Your epiglottis closes down like every anatomy professor on earth describes it, like a toilet seat cover going over the toilet seat. And the epiglottis flops down and covers up your trachea when you're swallowing to force everything just down into your esophagus. Well, in all other mammals, it is really high up in the throat, and it gives them a better separation of the two passageways. And in humans, it's down here. It's down here by, right at the top of your voice box. And so that is like, well, why'd we do that? Like, why make yourselves choking prone. And the thinking is that if it's high up, it's way up in your throat, you can make noise, but you can't form it into words. And if it's lower down in your throat, then as you push that air up through, you have the space and the flexible tongue and muscles to shape it into language. So it looks like there's this trade-off in humans between the likelihood of choking and the ability to speak, which that alone right there, I thought that was just the coolest thing I might've learned in the whole process of writing the book. I went around and talked to some of my biologists and I was like, am I the only one that doesn't know this? Like, is this, and most of them had never heard of it either. And I thought, oh, I gotta write about this because it's just the most fascinating thing in the world.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a thread throughout that book about the trade-offs of, apart from natural selection, there are trade-offs with various parts of your body. We haven't got time, obviously, to talk about everything in the book. Is there a particular issue with the human body that you'd like to talk about, Alex, that you could share with listeners?
I don't know. For me, the most interesting chapter in the book for me, and the one where I learned the most, and that really was what this project was until it became a book. It was just sort of a fun way for me to learn more about the human body. The most interesting chapter for me is the chapter on menstruation. I came to that chapter. So the overarching question being, why do human females menstruate? And with the recognition that most mammals do not. So most people have a misconception about this. They see a little blood on their dog or something, and they think that that's their dog menstruating, and it's not. That's their dog coming into heat. Totally different end of the reproductive process. The vast majority of mammals don't menstruate. And so humans are one of the sort of oddball mammals that do. And that chapter has, I just learned so much in that chapter about female reproductive biology and the evolution of that topic. It's almost, that one's almost too complicated to try to describe in a sort of in a sound bite, but just that's one where I would drive people to the book. The answers are so fascinating. There's this trade-off kind of between mother and child where the child has its own interests and it's trying to kind of get everything it can from the mother in terms of oxygen and sugar for its development. And the mother obviously needs to do that to develop the child, but she also has to protect herself to a degree, or the child will kind of, you know, go a little too far. And that's how you end up with conditions like gestational diabetes and preeclampsia. And kind of long story short, it seems like menstruation and changing that uterine lining in preparation for pregnancy rather than in response to pregnancy, that's how other mammals do it, doing it every month spontaneously in preparation, it looks like it may be sort of a defensive move on the way of human mothers to kind of build up a layer of protection before pregnancy so that that little developing fetus can't suck you dry. Fascinating biology, really modern too. Like a lot of this is really only coming to light in recent years as people are starting to research it. And I just thought that was, for me, that's the most interesting chapter of the book.
Yeah, I found that chapter interesting. And you'd also mentioned earlier in the book that some of the sort of academic research, I say research, that had been done a century or so ago was questionable.
It was all male led too. Like, no, there weren't any women weren't allowed into the research game until way too late in the process. And once women were allowed in and to work on that, all kinds of new ideas came to the table, and it's really pushing the research forward in a place that is becoming very fruitful.
Yeah. I'm keen to talk. There's two things I'd like to sort of round off on in terms of evolution and how we see it go. One is, the future. So I was thinking, so we now rely on our smartphones, and I'm talking here about brains. We rely on our smartphones, and it must have, this is just my own sort of hypothesis, it must mean that we are subcontracting out a lot of our short-term memory to devices. So, for example, you know, I can remember years ago not using sat-nav, but somehow I got there. And all this sort of stuff. Do you think the impact of digital technology and smartphones and stuff, do you think that is going to have an effect on the evolving of our brains going forward?
Oh, I think there's zero question that it's going to have an effect. And then you start to wonder, you know, what is the effect going to be? Because it's kind of like we talked about earlier, where, you know, if you're shifting the natural selection away from your teeth and jaw in that realm, you're shifting it onto other things. And so I think that's what's going to happen with the use of this kind of technology is, sure, we're becoming less dependent on the ability to recall things on our own without the help of a device. But at the same time, that's, you know, then you're shifting the pressure in another direction. You're shifting the pressure into a different kind of problem solving, right? And you're making, and I suspect we're probably making other newer neuronal connections that we've never made before that are then going to be tested in the realm of natural selection. So you're absolutely right. There's no question that, I mean, people get the misimpression that sort of, you know, with all the modern technology and modern medicine and everything that, you know, is that curbing natural selection, is that curbing evolution. And no, it's just pivoting it into different realms. And Now, whether or not those are, you know, whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, you can debate all day, but it's definitely happening. Mm. And I think what the impacts are largely unpredictable. But there's no question that it's pushing evolution in different directions. And of course, I don't know what your second one is, but the other one that's really an interesting talking point, you need to have an entire other episode about it. You can find somebody that is an expert in it, is this new opening up of the field of gene editing. You know, for the first time in human history, we now have the ability to go in and scrub out a gene and replace it or fix it or change it. That is a total game changer in terms of our relationship with evolution. And we have to figure out ethically where we want to be in that discussion and in that realm, and how we can use it for good and not just use it in twisted ways. And we're just right at the dawn of that right now.
Yeah, I can see that we are getting to that world of sort of science fiction. I'm not saying it's good or bad to sort of subcontract our memory out, because we're exposed to a lot more information anyway. So you could argue that we're becoming so exposed to macro information that actually we need that technology to help us process it and refine it. So that's an interesting one.
I remember reading something in recent years about the, you know, kids, the older generation was lamenting about, oh, kids don't ever read anymore these days, and they don't ever read this and that. And it's true. Like, I wish kids would read more books. But then somebody just put up just the raw amount of words that kids read, you know, compared to previous generations. And if you just look at it through that lens, they're reading, kids are reading because they text so much and because they're on social so much. Like, kids are actually reading more than any other generation has ever read in the history of humanity. Now, whether or not it's doing them any good, because it's all just, you know, emojis and LOLs, who knows? But they are reading a lot. It's just maybe not what we want them to be reading.
Yeah. The final topic really was, and it just dawned on me when I keep saying reading the book, when I listened to the book.
Yeah.
Was the what, you know, all this information that we've got, notwithstanding amending genes and things like that, we've got all this stuff. So for example, I'm a runner, but I've got problems with my knees.
Yeah.
Should I have known about that, or could I have known about I've got a muscular skeletal issue coming up, and would there be a way of doing it? So I'm thinking, I mean, I stretch most days now. I do a Pilates thing just in front of YouTube. Which I find really good, but there must be opportunities for educating people into how they can alleviate some of these issues that they are undoubtedly going to get in the future, don't you think?
Without a question. And the skeletal chapter really makes me think of that. So I think about all the ligament issues that athletes tend to deal with, and it seems a lot of it has to do with training and strengthening. So it's a strengthening issue, and it's a flexibility issue. And it's also the way that they're showing with basketball players and soccer players. It's a real issue in terms of learning to sort of cut and jump and land appropriately and land in ways that decrease the strain on the knee. And so there've been lots of interesting, I mean, scientists are such crafty groups. Like, I can really quickly figure out, you know, when I'm reading a research article, you know, how well controlled and how, you know, and the first thing you're looking for when you're reading a research article is, did they take a group of people and randomly divide them and then sort of run their experiment for a number of years? And, you know, so I really like studies that are prospective studies that are where they are sort of starting at the beginning rather than trying to look back in time. And if you look at studies where they take athletes, randomly divide them, put you guys through the training regimen, you guys not, follow them for 5 years, there is a lot to it. You can, you know, there's just one example where you can decrease ACL tear rates if you help young kids, you know, 13, 15, you know, 15, 17, 19 years old, as they're going on and playing all these sports so much, you can decrease those tear rates by helping them learn to move their body in a way that makes it less likely. We're prone to it. We're prone to those injuries as humans.
So ACL is to do with the knee, isn't it?
Yeah, the ACL is one of the main supportive ligaments in the knee, and it is one of the most it's one of the most common sort of serious knee injuries that athletes suffer, and it's one that is, you get it in the sports that involve a lot of pivoting and cutting. You don't get it in sort of straight line sports like tennis players almost never tear their ACLs. It's an injury for footballers and for basketballers. But there's an epidemic of ACL injuries, and some training on the front end would really help that.
I can see the appeal of frisbee throwing, frisbee golf.
Yeah, exactly. They end up hurting their elbows with repetitive stress injuries. So, you know, if you play anything you're gonna find a ligament to get sore if you do anything enough.
I was wondering whether they get frisbees in the head when they were
some contact.
If we've got any listeners out there who, and it does sound very fascinating, but if we've got any listeners out there who would like to become involved either as a mature student or they're looking for a career in biology and sort of an academic career, what advice would you give them, Alex?
That's a great question. I think the advice that I give a lot of my students that are sort of heading down this path, they're interested in biology, but they aren't quite sure, you know, where they want to end up. The first thing I tell them is to, you know, don't shy away from the more difficult path. There are going to be times in your academic career as you're going through school where you have a choice about what kind of classes to take. There's always those sort of required classes that everybody has to take. But then there's always classes that are the next level on top of that. And those are the ones where you really have a chance, I think, to form yourself as a biologist. And if you don't take don't just naturally go for the easiest road to hoe. Like don't just take the easy path. What it does then is it leaves you options. Like I got to because I took sort of the difficult undergraduate path, I didn't need to take that comparative animal physiology class. I didn't have to take 2 semesters of organic chemistry, but I decided to do it because it left me more options. When I got to the end of that point, I still had all kinds of things on the table that I could have done. I could have gone off and become a doctor. I could have gone off and become a dentist. I could have gone and become a genetic counselor. I could have gone and become a physical therapist. And I decided to go to graduate school and become an academic. That's my simple piece of advice is as you go through the process, take diverse classes. You know, I continue to take literature classes. I'm sure that helped the writing down the back end. I continue to take music classes, and that sort of helped my brain in other ways. So take diverse offerings, but also, you know, when you're sort of deciding, should I take that second semester of physics that I don't have to take? Just do it. It's going to leave more doors open down the line if you do. And that having that flexibility is really, really important when you get, as you're trying to sort of sort out what you want to do with your life.
Oh, well, that's great advice, Alex, particularly about the, you know, taking diverse subjects as well away from the main subject, just to keep your brain going.
Mainstream.
That's really good. So where can people find out more about your work and your book?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've done a number of events online where they can sort of find some presentation more like kind of things where I give more of a talk that goes along with it. So I have the most unique last name in the world. So any search into YouTube with that last name pretty much only pulls up me or my great uncle who was a filmmaker. And outside of that, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of the, or sort of earlier research work is out there in the world. But in terms of the book, that I would just encourage people to keep reading. I always like to tell people in these events, I always like to give some ideas of other good books. You know, if they read my book and they really like that, I don't have another one out yet. I'm working on it. But other books that I really like, I'll show you two examples. I love this book. This is a book called Gut that I have all of my second semester anatomy and physiology students read. I like to think it's kind of written like mine. It's a fascinating topic, but she writes it in a very, very accessible way. It's a fascinating tour through the gut. And then the other one, I don't have a copy of in my office, but the other one that I'm telling people to get in their hands is, it's called First Steps. It's by one of the world's leading researchers on, he's a paleoanthropologist, and he's sort of the foot fossil and bipedalism researcher. And he has written a book about that transition to walking on 2 feet for humans. That's the whole book, is just about that transition. So if you're really into sort of the skeletal issues, and his is the same way, I would never recommend a book that I thought was kind of boring and dry. He does it, his science is so sound, but he also writes in a really, really fun and interesting, accessible way. So that's First Steps by Jeremy Da Silva. Just, you know, keep reading books like that. And I don't know, just opens up everything, I think.
Well, we'll put those titles of those books on the show notes.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's been a really great conversation, Alex. Thank you ever so much for coming on. And I think it's been, like I said at the beginning, it's for me, it's been great because I've been able to read a book that I've been able to understand and sort of liking humour as well. That sort of helped it as well. So my guest today has been Alex Bezaridis. Alex is author of the book Evolution Gone Wrong, The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't. And you can find links to the book and Alex's website on the show notes. Thank you for coming on the show, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy reading.